Hello and welcome to the February 23rd edition of Ukraine Without Hype. I'm Anthony Bardaway, and I'm here on myself this episode because Romeo is on vacation and off on a road trip. There is a lot of ground to cover in this episode, so I'm not going to dwell too much on any one particular item. So let's just go over briefly what the episode will be about. First, of course, is the fall of Avdiivka. That is the number one story to tell in Ukraine. Next, we'll be talking about the anniversary of the Euromaidan. Then, continued problems on the Polish border, the death of Alexei Navalny, and just to give us a bit of a softer, sillier close for the episode, continue talking about the follow-up that Tucker Carlson made in Moscow, because it's fun to make fun of him. So, the combat update. Last episode, we were talking about how the Russians had cut a swath through the city of Avdiivka that essentially cut the northern part of the city from the southern part at the narrow neck that connected them. This proved to be the fatal blow to the defense of Avdiivka. This bisection of the city led to the southern part being almost entirely surrounded, especially as the southern defenses fell themselves. The most important of these southern defenses was the Zenit military base. This military base had been facing Donetsk City and, more importantly, Donetsk Airport since 2014 and has been a major part of Ukrainian defenses ever since then. The Russian advance threatened to completely surround Zenit, so the defenders of the strong point were able to escape under cover of night. However, because they had such a long distance to go by foot, they unfortunately had to leave their wounded behind. The wounded were executed by the Russians, while the survivors made it out, but taking heavy casualties on the way. This unfortunately proved to be a pattern in the fall of the southern part of Avdiivka. While the withdrawal was mostly successful, there were many units who were able to escape the city more or less unfazed. There were others who were caught into Russian pockets. Many of them were killed. There were some last stand moments, unfortunately, and prisoners of war, like with Zenit, many of them were executed. In the following days after the fall of the city on the 19th, the military had made the decision to withdraw on that day because the situation had become wholly untenable. So in the days following the 19th, we were receiving more pictures and video of Russian forces executing Ukrainian prisoners of war, including having their hands tied behind their back, lined up, and shot in the head. The instances of Russia executing prisoners of war has definitely become larger and larger in the recent months. We've talked about some of these other videos, but it has become quite common. In its last push to take Avdiivka, Russia was willing to take extremely heavy casualties to chase the Ukrainian forces out, including some days of, I'm pretty sure, the deadliest days for Russian forces of the entire war were those last about 3 days of trying to take Avdiivka and since then trying to push outwards from the city. The Russians know that right now Ukraine is at its most vulnerable moment, with all aspects of the front line reporting severe ammunition, especially artillery shell ammunition shortages, as a result of the loss of American aid. It is very possible that this aid might return. There's a attempt in the U.S. House of Representatives to force the issue to a vote, and if it is forced to a vote, the votes are there. It's just a matter of bypassing Republican leadership. So if it is possible to regain U.S. aid and to regain a steady supply of ammunition shells, then Ukraine will be able to shore up its defenses again. However, that is not where we are now. Where we are now is extreme ammunition hunger, and the Russians know that the harder they press, this is the moment where they can make some gains. Yes, hundreds of people died perhaps every day in the last sprint towards taking Avdiivka, but they don't care about that. This is their moment. So with Avdiivka falling, where are the next possible places Russia may attack? It's hard to say because, like I said, these problems exist everywhere. There's no one part of the front line where the Ukrainians have enough ammunition to do whatever they want with. That's just not the case anywhere. There could be a Russian breakthrough at any point. under those conditions. However, there's a few that the Russians are very concerned about. Of course, they're currently trying to break out of Avdiivka. There are a couple of villages around Avdiivka that are vulnerable because of this. But only a couple, about three or four. It's very possible that they may fall. Ukraine may be able to hold on to them as defensive points, but Russia is pushing pretty hard, so it's hard to say what that sector will look like. They're also gathering a large force around the area of the summer counteroffensive to get rid of that bulge in the Russian lines. There's, of course, Kupiansk up north. The Russians have been trying to take Kupiansk for months and months and months with no real forward momentum. However, the ability to direct resources away from Avdiivka may give them the push they need to finally show some progress in that sector. They may also continue to make further gains in Donbas region. However, to do that, they must first attack Chasiv Yar and New York. New York is not far to the north of Avdiivka, and it's very possible that that'll be the next target. There has been extreme shelling and rocket attacks on the cities of Slovyansk, Kramatorsk, and the rest of that urban conglomerate, which we've talked about in the past. This chain of cities that we've called like the real Battle of Donbas will take place there. They have been being hit more and more, and to get to this area, the Russians must first go through Chasiv Yar and New York. So those two places are on the list of possible Russian offensives as well. They may pick and choose which of these areas to go at the most. They may prioritize, or they may just be attacking everything and seeing what breaks. In addition to, they may dedicate more resources to dislodging the Ukrainian beachhead on the eastern side of the Dnipro River outside of Kherson. So that's also another possibility. As for Avdiivka, well, what's there to say about Avdiivka that we've not already said? I posted on our Patreon page a collection of photographs of the city of Avdiivka from the December before the full-scale invasion, right before things got really bad. It's, you know, a dirty industrial town, working class as it gets. And that's all in the past tense. Avdiivka no longer exists. Every building has been damaged or entirely destroyed. The people are almost all gone. There were some last-minute evacuations of the people who were too infirm to flee before then. Some were left behind. There are also stories of some of these last residents of Avdiivka fleeing their homes and telling reporters about how their neighbors had been killed by the Russians on the way out. Kind of like what happened in Bakhmut. As Wagner moved into Bakhmut, they had an open fire policy where they just wiped out entire families, and in some neighborhoods left no survivors. That is what Russia does. Where Russia appears, there is only pain and death. In Avdiivka, this Russian-speaking Donbas city that the Russians said they came to liberate is utterly destroyed. As for casualties, a very prominent Russian military blogger, Andrei Morozov, claimed that Russia lost 16,000 soldiers as deaths, not just wounded, but deaths, or permanent disfigurement. And that could be higher. I would guess it's a little bit higher. Russians tend to underreport quite severely. But even then, that's, you know, one Afghanistan war to take Avdiivka. The amount of casualties that Russia took, the amount of casualties that the Soviet Union took in the entirety of the Afghan war was comparable to the amount of casualties they took to take Avdiivka. Though apparently, Morozov, after posting this information, was approached by some of his military superiors and told to cut it out, at which point he killed himself. Whether he had an option to kill himself or not, we don't know. But the other element of that is, just like as Bakhmut very severely shifted the Russian internal dynamics through the elimination of the Wagner Group, and especially through the coup they attempted shortly thereafter, This is not as big of a change, of course, but Morozov represented something interesting, which was he was almost the last of the big Russian military bloggers that we've talked about. These, you know, very nationalistic, very pro-war, you know, fascists, but they had a degree of independence of thought and analysis that the Russian authorities did not appreciate very much. And with Morozov gone, there's no one quite to his level that's left. So this is really the end of the Russian mil blogger as well. And the military blogger is now extinct in Russia. That whole counterculture, I guess you can call them, the last of them just died. But that's Avdiivka. It should be mourned. Some are trying to say this was not, you know, a strategically important city. That's wrong. It was quite strategically important. Others are saying that the withdrawal from Avdiivka was so successful that it was basically a victory. No, it was not. It was quite disorganized and messy and should have happened weeks sooner. We at Ukraine Without Hype, as always, do not like these big emotional swings in either direction. This was a pretty serious loss. Do not try to hide that. This is also not the collapse of the Ukrainian military. Don't get that hyped up on that either. This was a very serious defeat, but what it also did is that the front line has been flattened in that zone, which means that it is much more easy to defend any other point other than Avdiivka, more easily than Avdiivka. Avdiivka was the most vulnerable thing. So right now, there's not an obvious next battle that is in as bad a position as Avdiivka was. Take everything with a sober analysis. But Avdiivka represents something else, which was this front line of the 2014 war. This battle has been ongoing for nearly 10 years there. Not just these last 4 months, but 10 years. So this next news item takes us to those 10 years ago. February 20th is the day of the Heavenly Hundred Heroes. The Euromaidan Revolution, in its last about week or so, was when it was at its most bloody. While there had been deaths before then, there had been people taken out into the woods and left to die. There had been other casualties along the way. These last few days were when most of what we call the Heavenly Hundred lost their lives. When the riot police and special forces opened fire with live ammunition, killing about 100 of them. This was the end of the Yanukovych government. The government simply could not continue to exist after they did this. That was unacceptable. Before that point, there was no discussions. Maybe there would be early elections or something. But the massacre of the Heavenly Hundred put that all to an end. There could only be revolution. That was on February 20th. Yanukovych fled the 23rd. So as I'm releasing tomorrow. And we'll have someone to talk about that in our next week's episode. Hopefully, as long as everything scheduling works out, we will. The 20th was also important is that it was the beginning of the process of the invasion and annexation of the Crimean Peninsula by Russia. This is when they really started to take moves towards the beginning of that process, though the Russians would invade on the 27th. We do also treat the 20th as the start of the Russia-Ukraine war, so 10 years of war. I would very much encourage you all to go back and listen to episode 65. We spoke with Olga Tokariuk. She was there on Maidan. She was a protester. She took part in the revolution and told us about her experiences there. Romy and I also shared our own experiences with that time period. So again, episode 65, please go back and listen to that. There's not much more I can say outside. So that was a pretty big moment, especially when February 24th, of course, it's the anniversary of the beginning of the war, of this current full-scale invasion phase of the war, rather. It's a very heavy week for everyone. So again, tune in next week. We'll be talking about it a bit more broadly after these dates have all fully passed. We're in the middle of them right now. Our next news item is back to the Polish border. To catch you up, if you haven't been following us, essentially, there were a lot of Polish farmers who were very upset that Ukrainian grain was entering the Polish market, therefore depressing the price of grain in competition with Polish grain. You know, very simple trade protectionist stuff. As the story developed, you know, there would be some borders closed down, just the roads, but not the trains. It has been, for the last few months, this has gone up and down in importance, up and down in severity, up and down in how many people are involved. You know, it's been a very evolving story. I was under the impression that things might get better after the incoming more liberal government of Poland, after the collapse of the previous more conservative one. That Prime Minister Tusk, the new Prime Minister of Poland, who is much more of a Eurocrat type, would take a harder line on enforcing EU policy. That Poland cannot just shut off its border unilaterally, that's not how the European Union works. There had been a lot of concessions to the Polish side, for example, that Ukrainian grain would not go directly to the Polish market, it could only be transited through Poland to other markets. The claim now is that some of this grain, after being sold in, say, Lithuania, was then resold in Poland, essentially making Poland the final destination for that grain anyway and still depressing prices. The extent of this, I don't really wish to speak on because I don't feel like that's the most important thing. These are the things that can be settled through international arbitration. This is something that's supposed to happen in Brussels. This is something that's supposed to go through official channels. Trade disputes happen all the time. Trade disputes happen all the time between friendly countries. There are many trade disputes that have happened between the United States and Canada, two of the best BFFs in the world. It's not an unusual happenstance. However, this newest push, this newest border blockade by the farmers, is worse. This new push is they are trying to shut down everything, trying to shut down the border crossings of the roads, the railroads, and the ports where they're going to, even. So much more severe in that way, when before, like, you know, there'd only be like half of the borders closed and things would kind of work their way through anyway, they've now declared they've been wanting to block off everything. The Polish farmers, I mean. The Polish farmers, I mean, who are very connected to the Konfederacja Party, the extreme right-wing party in Poland that is connected to Russian interests. Meanwhile, at the border, they have been stopping and harassing buses full of just normal people. Ukrainian for the holidays, you know, women and children, just passenger buses have been stopped, you know, they're banging on the windows, demanding to see people, taking them out, asking them questions. These are not border police. These are not border police. These are just regular people protesting, deciding to insert themselves as the border police and as customs officers. It's not something that happens in a state that has rule of law. And the other thing that's made Ukrainians especially angry is that a lot of the buses or a lot of the trucks and including trains, cargo trains, these farmer protesters have opened them up and spilled the grain and other agricultural products all over the ground, dumping small fields worth of yield. This is something that has been considered extremely insulting, not just because, you know, it's, you know, vandalism. It's a desecration. I've, you know, mentioned this on Twitter, but one of the most impactful moments of this war for me was being at a forward operating base in the Mykolaiv region when that was the front line. And while there, the next door neighbor was a farmer still tending his crops. The Ukrainian farmer has dealt with occupation, mines, artillery being shot at, risking their lives to take that grain to export because it is their lives to do so. And even deeper than that, this is a country that in the 1930s was starved to death by the Soviet Union stealing its grain and causing people to starve. Now, this grain is not for Ukrainian tables. It's for export, so it's not like we're being starved by it. But there's a very inbuilt Ukrainian cultural trait that wasting grain, wasting bread, it's visceral to see. And the Polish farmers knew it. Keep saying farmers. These are landlords, mainly. Far-right activists who apparently do not need to actually be on their farms farming. So it's a very tricky word, farmer, of what it means to who. There have been attempts to resolve this crisis. Zelensky has called for Tusk to meet him at the border to try and resolve this issue. Tusk turned the deal down, saying that they're going to meet next month anyway. This is a pretty immediate concern, it needs immediate action. But what he did do, what the Polish government did do, was declare that border crossings would be critical infrastructure, meaning that there'd be more of a legal framework in place to deal with people who were vandalizing, blocking it, etc. What that has meant so far has not really been made clear yet. These blockages still exist, but I guess there's now some legal framework to go offer them more severely if the Polish government chooses to do so. The other factor here is that more broadly, these farmers, like I said, are elements of the far right in Poland. The far right in Poland is overall having a complete breakdown at the moment over their loss in the most recent elections. It's hard to go into how severe this breakdown is. It's a very extreme temper tantrum. I don't know how to sufficiently go into it. A very severe temper tantrum. And unfortunately, this is the part of it that is least impactful to the Polish government, this border blockade. If they are going to prioritize where to fight the far right, this is probably not going to be it. It is the hardest place to do it because this issue of Ukrainian agriculture products outcompeting Polish ones and in price, that is something that has some salience in Polish society. So there is a bit of sympathy for these protests, even for people who are themselves not far right. So that's a hard place to fight them on. It's also something set aside. It's not something that's affecting the average Polish person or is not as visible, I should say. So, for example, the Polish government trying to dismantle how the right had basically captured government-funded media, that is another one of the priority right now, is that they're fighting them to kind of retake the public media. And that is a much more, of course, public fight to have. So burning through political resources to fight multiple things at once. I understand the position he's in, but he's still not, the Prime Minister Tusk is in, but he's still not taking this as seriously as he ought to. Maybe in this meeting next month, something will happen. Maybe this situation of calling border crossings critical infrastructure will lead to more consequences. But so far, as of time recording, no actual forward movement. Our next topic that I think is most prominent in Western headlines right now is the death of Alexei Navalny. Alexei Navalny was a anti-corruption opposition figure within Russia. He has had many famous investigations, for example, into Putin's mansion, his Black Sea mansion near Sochi, that area. One of his bigger ones was the extreme corruption of the former president / former prime minister of Russia, Dmitry Medvedev, how he is a complete crook. That was actually a pretty big one. Medvedev went from being treated like the darling of the American liberal expectations of Russia to, after that investigation, being treated as, you know, a common criminal. That was a pretty big one, I think, on Navalny's side. But at one point in the year 2020, while on a plane ride, he was poisoned and took a very severe medical consequences of this poisoning. There is a documentary about this called, well, Navalny, simple enough. But after he recovered from the poisoning, he decided to go back to Russia. This was widely seen as a bad decision. The Russians obviously were trying to kill him. He was on a death list. He did not want to be yet another Russian opposition figure in Riga, in London, in Berlin, that could be a darling of the Western press, but had no influence whatsoever in Russia itself. He saw his fight as only being able to continue in Russia. Upon his return in 2021, he was arrested, sent to a series of prisons in increasingly horrible circumstances, and this time he was all the way up in the Arctic Circle. He was frequently in solitary confinement, he was denied medical aid, likely tortured, and withering away, until eventually he died. He died specifically, we don't know. He could have just continued his health decline and died, quote-unquote, naturally, or the Russians could have taken him out directly. Either way, Russia obviously is the cause of this man's death. In the wake of his death, the international media gave it a lot of attention. He was very, very well known. in Western capitals, media. He was a very large personality. He was treated as the leader of the Russian opposition. So there's a lot of international outrage about this, including one bill that is going on in Europe to seize Russian assets was named after Navalny because of this. So I've presented a pretty glowing picture of Navalny himself in the tragedy that happened. Know, however, that he is controversial. In his past, Alexei Navalny was aligned with the far right and said some pretty nasty things about minorities. Central Asians, Caucasians, as in, you know, from the Caucasus region, not white people, but Azeris, Armenians, Georgians, Chechens, that Caucasus. And as far as Ukraine is concerned, he very famously said about the possible return of Crimea to Ukraine that, quote, Crimea is not a sandwich. It's not something that can just be passed between people. It was, he opposed the annexation, but giving it back, would he was also opposed to giving it back. Now, he has evolved on these positions. He has put his far-right racist background, he's not really done that in like over 10 years. And in his most recent statements about Ukraine, he was 100% anti-war, 100% you know, returning all of Russian-occupied territory back to the 1991 borders. His final positions on these things had recovered. However, his personality was still very caustic, still very confrontational on it. I never particularly liked his answers to questions about his racist path. He'd just always say, I've answered questions about this before, we can move on. Though I don't think he ever actually answered that question. There's also the organizing central part of this problem with Navalny that speaks to the Russian opposition as a whole. Navalny was ultimately a Russian personality. By that I meant he cared first and foremost about his country, which you can't fault someone for. He's a Russian, he cared about Russia, he wanted Russia to be better. But that came with a whole list of assumptions that he did not truly question, and the Russian opposition as a whole has not truly questioned. He thought of the problem with Russia being solely an issue of kleptocracy, that everything else merely served to help Putin and his cadres to better steal from the Russian people, and in this case also the Ukrainian people, that it was solely about personal gain, that if you replaced these thieves with people who were not thieves, such as himself, as he presented, then the problems with Russia would quickly right themselves. Now, if you were to say that in the 2000s, I think you'd have more people listening to you as that being the case. However, it's not the 2000s. We saw that Russia is deeply ideological, that Russia is deeply imperialistic. In order to carry out this war, they had to sacrifice a lot of economic activity. They had to, now a lot of this they're able to get around, they've been able to circumvent a lot of sanctions, but the willingness to make sacrifices on that kleptocracy in order to make the ideological goal was there. Russia is not erasing Ukrainian identity as some kind of pyramid scheme. Russia is not stealing and raping and murdering just so some other Russians have a better opportunity to steal from the Russian coffers. It's plenty easy to do that in peacetime. A war was not necessary for that. As we saw, there had been extensive stealing from the Russian military during the pre-invasion period, which severely hindered their ability to actually fight the war. The kleptocracy and the imperialism partially feed into each other, but also partially work at odds with each other. So to just make it about just the kleptocracy, huge, huge, huge blind spot on his part, as well as the part of the rest of the Russian opposition. The fact is, Russia, as it is constituted right now, is the problem. Russia defines itself as an imperialistic, kleptocratic state and society. These things are not genetic or anything like that. Look at, you know, Germany before 1945. You could say many of the same things about them. Japan, like all manner of countries who are deeply, deeply involved in fascistic processes that were heavily backed by their population that have since been made normal. It's not impossible for Russia to be made normal. However, That requires a level of introspection about the nature of Russian identity that they have thus far been unable to ask themselves. However, this element of the Russian opposition does exist within the ethnic minorities. There is currently still protests in Bashkortostan that we covered a few episodes ago. In some of this, I'm not going to pretend they're wholly anti-system. They're not trying to overthrow the Russian government or anything like that, but they are rooted in the idea that these groups do have a distinct national identity separate from the overarching Russian imperial identity that they're being asked to absorb. They have an alternative. They have being Tatar. They have being Bashkort. They have being Chechen or Circassian or Yakut or any of these other things. They have something else to be. And that makes it a bit easier to say that I don't have to be this Russian imperialist thing. I can be something else. Whereas the Navalnyist, more nationalist form of opposition is much more rooted in the idea of just being Russian and therefore purging themselves of the imperialistic assumptions built into Russian identity over the course of the last few hundred years. It's a task. Some of them have been up to it. Many of them have not. There have been a lot of instances of Russian opposition treating themselves as still the kind of the main characters of Eastern Europe, lecturing liberals in Ukraine, Belarus, the Baltic states, the Caucasian states, Central Asia, lecturing them as them still being the big brothers with everyone else having to listen. Now, they're lecturing on liberalism in this case, but still with that very Russian attitude that they just know better, that the West should deal with them first and foremost, etc. So these are a lot of the frustrations that Ukrainians have been expressing over Navalny, over the Western reaction to Navalny. But then going back to how I was talking about beforehand, he did make a lot of these important gains. He did make a lot of these very important points in Russia. He was a crusader for anti-corruption. He was anti-war. But then everything else I just said. In balance, Navalny was a complicated person. And as the bard said, the evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred with their bones. And while I did make all these criticisms just now, that is meant as constructive criticism, I should say. And a lot of people, especially in Eastern Europe, but also in Russia especially, are there to criticize the Navalny legacy. But that's the other thing with the Russian, like Russians criticizing him for being a racist politician in the past. Like, he expressed pretty normal Russian attitudes. It's just that those normal Russian attitudes were quite disgustingly racist. And seeing like these weird far right people in the US and Europe trying to criticize Navalny for being anti-immigrant. Look at, who are you trying to kid with that anyway? But Navalny joins very prestigious list. Anna Politkovskaya, Alexander Litvinenko, Boris Nemtsov, so many people, when they are inconvenient to the Russian regime, they are simply killed. Through this process, Russia has lost any real opposition. Maybe that's another criticism, is that the Russian opposition is very tied to individual personalities. The death of Alexei Navalny is seen as the death of the Russian opposition as a whole, though his wife, his widow, is trying to take up the mantle. It's easy to kill a person, and if you're only going to be killing a person, if that can wipe out an entire movement, it's not a strong movement. Euromaidan, as we were talking about with the anniversary, that was a decentralized movement with no real leaders, though some tried to praise themselves as leaders. None of them really were. And that is what made it successful. If any one of them was gone, there'd be others. With Russia, it seems if any one of them is killed, if any one of them is bought out by the Kremlin, it's a very serious blow. And that is the difference between the Ukrainian liberal movement and the Russian liberal movement. As we've been talking about, Russia, vertical society dependent on leaders, Ukraine, horizontal society dependent on emergent leadership and cooperation. One succeeded, the other didn't, at least as far as opposition to tyranny. But as Navalny is the most famous person to die in a Russian prison, he'll not be the only one. Within the same couple-day time frame, I'd like to turn your attention to one Father Stepan Podolchak. He was an Orthodox priest in the town of Kalinchak in occupied Kherson region. The Russian authorities demanded that he convert to the Russian Orthodox Church as opposed to the Orthodox Church of Ukraine. He drew attention for leading sermons in the Ukrainian language and for practicing his faith. He was brought in by the Russian occupation security services, tortured, killed, and dumped on the streets of his town. There are Crimean Tatar activists who have been in jail for years, some dying in jail, some simply just being harassed periodically. The untold numbers of Ukrainians who are taken to Russian torture chambers, the basements in some of the villages around Kyiv that during the siege of the city, the Russians used as torture chambers that were discovered with dozens of bodies inside. In Kherson, torture chambers for children, specifically children. So, yes, Navalny's death was a tragedy. It was the death of one of the last Russian opposition figures. There's still a few, Karamurza and others who need to be paid attention to. But just because someone's not famous doesn't mean they're not important. These other people that have been killed and died and were tortured and had everything taken from them in Russian custody, they matter too. The only way to prevent these things from happening in the future in Ukraine is to drive out the Russians. The only thing that will prevent them from happening in Russia in the future is to overthrow Putin and overthrow Russian autocracy. And just pointing out that some of them are thieves isn't going to accomplish that. I don't know. I kind of rambled on that idea. There's a lot of ideas going back and forth there. I admired a lot of his work. Was not a fan in other aspects. A lot of frustrations over how Russian opposition is treated as opposed to Ukrainians. There's so much there. Years of built up frustrations that are hard to get to in just this one segment. So I'll just move on before I linguistically tie myself in even more knots. And give this episode a nice soft landing by going back to Tucker Carlson. Oh my, so Tucker Carlson, as we talked about in our last episode, did his big interview with Putin. Putin just rambled on like a drunk racist uncle for an hour, or 2 hours, sorry, 2 hours. And we pointed out all the ways in which this interview was ridiculous, but because Tucker Carlson himself decided to continue on with this ridiculous farce, I'll continue coverage of said farce. After the release of this interview, he did 3 more segments out of Russia that were just straight up like Stalin-era propaganda. So setting the stage for this, visitors to the Soviet Union were allowed a very curated experience. They were taken to the Moscow subway, where they were shown its beauty and its well-designed, the craftsmanship, the Baroque and neoclassical elements that turned it into a true architectural marvel for the people. They're taken to specific locations that were meant to make the Soviet Union look as good as possible. So what are the 3 locations that Tucker Carlson decided to show off as his version of this propaganda? 1, a grocery store, 2, a McDonald's, and 3, the same thing, the metro. So like I said with the metro, Russian subway stations are nice. Soviet subway stations in general are quite nice. Kyiv has very nice metro stations, especially Universitat has some of the better look to it. Is it cool to see? Yes. Tucker Carlson suddenly deciding that he likes public transit because he sees it? Come on. McDonald's, of course, he prattled on about how it's so much healthier. It's still McDonald's. I can vouch for the fact that McDonald's outside of the U.S. tends to not be as heavy feeling as McDonald's in the U.S., but it's hardly a modern marvel. Again, Ukraine, same thing. McDonald's is not as bad as U.S. McDonald's. Or specifically, he went to the replacement for McDonald's. McDonald's pulled out of Russia, and the local company that ran McDonald's in Russia simply, you know, swapped the logo and the name and are a new thing. It's still McDonald's, but not actually McDonald's, if that makes sense. They took the supply chain, they took the locations, they took really most of the recipes and called it something else. But the one that really blew my mind was the grocery store. He went to Auchan. Auchan is not a Russian chain. It's a French chain. Again, we have it in Ukraine as well. And quite frankly, we probably shouldn't. Ashan working in Russia is bad. It should be sanctioned or that. But anyway, Ashan is not a high-end grocery store. It is quite middle of the road. The good grocery store is Silpo, or the better version of that, because French is fancy, Les Silpo are the good grocery stores that blew the grocery store that Booker went to out of the water. It was silly him like, oh, look at this bread. I've never seen bread before, but the most frustrating part was the price. Now, it's my understanding that in America, there is a bit of a panic about the growing cost of groceries. Well, in the grand scheme of thing, American groceries are quite inexpensive. As far as, you know, how much you make versus how much you spend on groceries, America is about the bottom of the list on a global level. Americans spend a smaller percentage of their paycheck on groceries than just about anyone. So Tucker decided to say, well, isn't it crazy how I just bought groceries for a week and it cost $100? Ignoring the fact that in Russia, the average wage, well, is closer to, what, like $500, like $600? $100 is a lot of money in Russia. The way he described it, it's like that's a very significant part of your paycheck is going to that 1 week in groceries, Tucker. Do some research, Tucker. Have some basic idea of how things work economically, Tucker. Carlson is a millionaire. He's always been a millionaire. He came from money. He's always had money. It's unlikely he's ever gone grocery shopping at any time in his life. It is the scene from Arrested Development where the late, great Jessica Walter said, it's just a banana. How much could it cost? $10. Same thing here. He simply has no concept of money, and he didn't realize how much he just spent. He also marveled at an escalator that could handle grocery baskets and was amazed of the idea of putting the coin in the grocery basket so homeless people wouldn't steal them. Like, we have that in America as well. Calm yourself. I don't know. Silly guy. And watching him go from that interview, which was an accidental bit of exposure of the utter depravity of the Russian system, to immediately switching to doing the most basic silly Russian propaganda I've ever seen, and within that Russian propaganda still showing that Russians don't have it very good due to his own ignorance of how money works. I had to get that off my chest. Don't really need to care about Tucker Carlson as much, but he is unfortunately still quite an important voice on the American right during this legal battle where the American right is blocking aid to Ukraine, partially because of their Russian sympathies. So it is still important to point out how truly comedically stupid these Russian sympathies manifest themselves. So that's the end of this episode. Like I said, next week we'll be trying to put something together for all the anniversaries I listed. The Euromaidan Revolution and the beginning of the war in Ukraine in 2014, as well as the beginning of the full-scale invasion 2 years ago. So until that time, please look to our link tree in the description for more resources on Ukraine, as well as places you can donate some of your money to good causes. Please rate us, review us, tell your friends about us. Please petition your congresspeople for support for Ukraine aid. That's more important than anything else I can be saying. Do that. If you'd like to support this podcast financially, you can go to patreon.com/UkraineWithoutHype to keep the lights on. There you can join our Discord channel. And like I said, I added some photos of Avdiivka that I think are worth looking at. So I'd like to thank our Patreon subscribers. So thank you very much. Deborah Grazer. The voices in my head are from Big Pharma. David Shepard. Giorgio. Ivana Kukuryatskaya. Michael Drucker. Anna Karen Person. Anonymous. Dennis Napalm. Devi. Dimitri Litvin. Etienne. James Burke. Jan. Inara. Denny Louise. Kevin Albertan. Marguerite. Michael Wickman. Mike Perrone. PLM. Shieldwall. Silas Frank. T. Bart, Vivek, Adam Poppenheimer, Ada McDonnell, Alex Crochmal, Anastasia, Barbara, Captain Technical, Chris Bennington, Daniel Spring, David Wall, Emily Bavona, Francois, Grace Kraus, Had to Laugh, Jacob Hoem, James Wise, Jared Bradley, Jerd, Julia Lindsay, Laura De Leon, Libby Grove, Marianne, Matt Miller, Melissa Selko, Anonymous, Noam Hart, Paul Bailey, Randy McNerlin, RDK, Sanjay, Scott Berry, Skengris, Scott Torkiuk, Steve Bien, Stuart Akers, Subtle Knight, Life, Thomas Sobiek, Veronica, Tori Leontineva, and Wandering Lens. Thank you all very much for making this all possible. And until next episode, Slava Ukraini!